There are numerous claims in mythologies and folklore from around the world that speak of massive inhabited portions inside of the Earth's crust, as well as several alleged maps which purport to disclose the location of entrances to these subterranean worlds below our feet. Before we get to them, I'd first like to present some of the inner Earth stories which help illustrate what is postulated by some to exist in these massive underground caverns alluded to in myths and legends. The Smoky God, or A Voyage to the Inner Earth, is a book written in 1908, presented as a true account of a Norwegian sailor who sailed with his father through an entrance to the Earth's interior at the North Pole. The story opens with Olaf Jansen reminiscing about his childhood in the coastal village of Tonsberg, Norway, and his father's lifelong fascination with the unexplored regions of the Arctic. Determined to uncover the mysteries hidden beneath the icy surface, they set sail from Stockholm on their modest fishing vessel. They navigate through treacherous waters, battling fierce storms and freezing temperatures, and after days of sailing, Olaf and his father encounter an unexpected phenomenon, a thick fog known as a Smoky God enveloping the North Pole. Intrigued by this mysterious occurrence, they navigate through the mist until they discover a peculiar opening leading into the Earth's interior. Without hesitation, they venture into the unknown, eager to unravel the secrets that lie beneath the surface. Upon entering the inner Earth, Olaf and his father are immediately struck by the breathtaking landscapes that unfold before them. Towering mountains rise majestically on the horizon, their peaks glistening in the ethereal light that emanates from the bioluminescent, glittering, lichen-filled caverns. Lush forests carpet the valleys below, teeming with vibrant flora and fauna unlike anything found on the surface. As they explore further, they're filled with a sense of wonder and awe at the sheer beauty of this hidden world. As Olaf and his father journey deeper into the subterranean world, they encounter a diverse array of plant life that thrives in the underground environment. Glowing mushrooms and plants with iridescent leaves sway gently, their branches adorned with exotic flowers that emit a soft, soothing glow. Moss-covered rocks and crystal-clear streams dot the landscape, creating a harmonious tapestry of colors and textures. Majestic birds with wings spanning vast distances soar gracefully overhead. Their melodic songs fill the air with enchanting melodies. Colorful butterflies flutter amidst the flowers and glowing fungus, while gentle woodland creatures and even reptiles roam freely through the forests. Everywhere they turn, they're greeted by the wonders of nature in all its splendor. In addition to the breathtaking landscapes, Olaf and his father also stumble upon ancient artifacts and ruins left behind by a civilization long forgotten. Intricate carvings adorn the walls of underground caverns, depicting scenes of life and culture from a bygone era. Mysterious symbols and inscriptions hint at the secrets of the inner earth, inviting them to unravel the mysteries that lie within. They marvel at the sheer scale and complexity of the subterranean world, filled with hidden treasures and ancient secrets waiting to be discovered. As Olaf and his father delve deeper into the inner earth, they discover a network of underground caverns and passageways that stretch for miles beneath the surface. Twisting rivers run through massive tunnels, leading them through a labyrinth of mazes, where every turn reveals new wonders and mysteries to behold. They navigate through winding passages and dimly lit chambers with a beautiful diffused glow of purples, greens and blues, guided by the faint glow of luminescent crystals that glow along the path. Along the way, they encounter strange rock formations and underground rivers, each more mesmerizing than the last. In their exploration of the inner earth, Olaf and his father stumble upon a hidden civilization known as Eden. The inhabitants are tall, with a blue-eyed Aryan phenotype, benevolent beings who possess advanced technology and wisdom far beyond anything they have ever encountered. The city of Eden is a marvel of architecture and engineering, with towering spires and gleaming domes that reach towards the top of the caves. As they interact with the inhabitants of Eden, Olaf and his father are welcomed with open arms, eager to learn more about this extraordinary civilization and how they seemed godlike compared to the surface people. As Olaf and his father immerse themselves in the culture of Eden, they learn about the history and customs of the inner earth Aryan people. They discover that the inhabitants of Eden have been living in harmony with nature for centuries, using their knowledge to maintain a perfect balance between the elements. Through their interactions with the unseen, they gain insights into the mysteries of the universe and interconnectedness of all living beings. They marvel at the advanced spiritual technology and scientific knowledge possessed by the inhabitants of Eden, eager to absorb as much wisdom as they can during their time in this hidden subterranean world. During their stay in Eden, Olaf and his father have the opportunity to explore the city and its many wonders. They marvel at the grandeur of the architecture, with gleaming buildings and intricate artwork adorning every street corner. They visit bustling marketplaces filled with exotic goods and activity, immersing themselves in the vibrant culture of the Smoky God. They are greeted with kindness and hospitality wherever they go, forging deep connections with the inhabitants of Eden as they continue their journey of exploration and discovery. As their time in Eden draws to a close, Olaf and his father reflect on their profound and captivating glimpse into a world of wonder and mystery hidden beneath the Earth's surface. Reminded of the surface people, many of whom remain totally unaware of this underground habitat and foolishly believe they are evolved from monkeys that came down from the surface trees. They are filled with gratitude and hospitality and wisdom that they've received from the inhabitants of the inner earth, vowing to carry their experience with them forever. With hearts full of memories and minds enlightened by their adventure, they bid farewell to Eden, setting sail once more for the surface. As they journey back to the world above, they carry with them the knowledge and wisdom they've gained, forever changed by their extraordinary voyage into the depths of the earth's inner sanctum. Olaf's accounts claim that he and his father accidentally stumbled into an entrance to the inner earth in the Arctic region and encountered a race of people with great stature, or giants. In the foreword, the author postulates that, quote, "As we approach the equator, the stature of the human race grows less, but the Patagonians of South America are probably the only aborigines from the center of the earth who came out through the aperture usually designated as the South Pole, and they are called the giant race." I've already covered the topic of giants in prior videos, which I'll leave a link to in the description. That said, here's a quote from the Smoky God describing the inner earth inhabitants. Quote, "There was not a single man aboard who would not have measured fully 12 feet in height. They all wore full beards, not particularly long, but seemingly short-cropped. They had mild and beautiful faces, exceedingly fair, with ruddy complexions. Their hair and beard of some were black, others sandy, and still others yellow. The captain, as we designated the dignitary in command of the great vessel, was fully a head taller than any of his companions. The women averaged from 10 to 11 feet in height. Their features were especially regular and refined, while their complexion was of the most delicate tint heightened by a healthful glow. They were richly attired in a costume peculiar to themselves and very attractive. The men were clothed in handsomely embroidered tunics of silk and satin and belted at the waist. They wore knee breeches and stockings of a fine texture, while their feet were encased in sandals adorned with gold buckles. We early discovered that gold was one of the most common metals known, and that it was used extensively in decoration. I never saw such a display of gold. It was everywhere. The door casings were inlaid, and the tables were veneered in sheetings of gold. Domes of the public buildings were of gold. It was used most generously in the finishings of the great temples of music." The story concludes after a period of time spent in this subterranean world, leaving through an opening to the surface around Antarctica, where the father died in a storm and the son, though rescued, was thrown into an insane asylum for daring to tell the world about where he and his father had been. While it is very easy to dismiss the story as fiction, it is hardly alone in its claims of an inhabited underground paradise that has been kept secret from the rest of humanity living on the surface. Which brings us to this very rare and special map printed in 1740 by Matthias Suter, one of the most important and prolific German map publishers of the 18th century. It is of Schlaraffenland, which is a land of milk and honey, a map of a German concept of utopia. The original map from which this engraving was made was supposedly dropped off at Mr. Suter's map shop, left right outside of his door, mysteriously just left there with no further information about it. For those interested, I go into more detail about this in my book called Gods with Amnesia. That said, this map is not of any known landmass on the surface of the earth, and has peculiar writing on it, such as saying the light is the same both day and night. I would like to now draw your attention to the bottom right-hand portion of the map, which I found extraordinarily interesting. The writing on it says, in German, and I'll translate, "a utopian map of the newly discovered Schlaraffenland. This land was often spoken of, but never located, and nobody knows where it is. This ridiculous fantasy land is composed of many kingdoms, which have all the different vices of life within them, and that this map was delivered by anonymous authors. Could this so-called fantasy map in actuality be giving us a clue as to the polar entrance to the inner earth, which piqued the interest of nationalist Germany in the early part of the last century? As you can see, the writing is on what appears to be a large rock, or a mountain, with four rivers running into it. Could this map be a portion of the inner world? If so, it lines up nicely with the Mercator map printed in 1613, the first map dedicated to the Arctic, where the North Pole is depicted as a giant, familiar-looking rock or mountain from which four rivers flow into. Now, what does that remind you of? There are numerous myths and legends regarding entrances to inhabited subterranean worlds at the poles, most taken very seriously by European secret societies of the 19th and 20th centuries. In the year 2000, the Cave of Crystals was discovered by miners excavating a tunnel for a mine in Mexico. The main chamber contains some of the largest natural crystals ever found in any underground cave. The largest one so far, measuring about 36 feet in length, 13 feet in diameter, and weighs over 55 tons. So these massive crystals are just spectacular. The gigantic, colossal crystals in this subterranean cave have become this large because of the extremely hot temperatures inside of the underground cavern, where it has reached a steamy 136 degrees Fahrenheit, and this encourages microscopic crystals to form, rapidly growing much faster than what we're used to seeing in cooler locations. Just gazing at these gigantic, beautiful crystals, one can't help but get carried away imagining what else awaits further exploration deeper inside these caves. That said, the tremendous subterranean heat got me thinking about another topic, cold-blooded reptiles. Reptiles are cold-blooded, meaning they cannot generate their own body heat, so they're dependent on the heat from their environment, which usually equates to sunlight, as that is the primary source of heat on the surface world. But that's not the case deep below the surface, where there's a constant, consistent warmth independent of sunlight, which seems reptiles are ideally adapted for, and which theoretically makes sense, to me at least, as a likely evolutionary origin for this ancient species, which may have originated deep within the earth, with some emerging onto the surface millions of years ago, and adapting to its new, inhospitable environment. If this was the case, then it might make sense for people as well. If you haven't already seen it, there's a link in the description to my video called Out of Africa Debunked, where I make the case against humanity's alleged arboreal origins from tree-dwelling primates, as the Darwinian model has yet to come up with a missing link, which remains elusive and still very much missing. That said, what if the ancient myths and legends about subterranean kingdoms is true, such as Agartha or Shambhala, which are popular in parts of Asia, such as Tibet or India, which claims that there are inner earth civilizations that are the true origins of the human race, which would explain why our alleged ape-like ancestor has never been found. There are numerous myths and legends passed down since remote antiquity concerning an ancient long-lost civilization that allegedly existed before a time of great cataclysm, which some say originated somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean, but most certainly had colonies all around the world as part of its expansive empire. We often hear mythologies that speak to a forgotten parent race which were revered as gods, and that taught various communities of tribal people about agriculture, astronomy, architecture, art, and spirituality. While many people point to places like Egypt, India, and Tibet, these are not the only places which hold clues to a forgotten past which may differ from the accepted history we're all taught in modern anthropology classrooms. As one of the seven wonders of the natural world, the Grand Canyon is a true national treasure. Carved by the Colorado River in Arizona, This steep-sided canyon is 277 miles long, up to 18 miles wide, and attains a depth of over a mile. For thousands of years, the area has been continuously inhabited by Native Americans who built settlements within the canyon and its many caves. The Pueblo people considered the Grand Canyon a holy site and made pilgrimages to it. The first academically accepted Europeans known to have viewed the Grand Canyon was in 1540, but this may not be the case, as there are many unusual stories associated with this area, some published and some passed down orally. The Hopi Indians maintained that their ancestors did not arrive from the north over a land bridge from Asia, nor do they believe that they arrived to the New World by boat, but instead, their origin myths tell the story of how they climbed onto the surface from the underworld. The specific location where the Hopi claim they emerged from took place in their legends deep inside the Grand Canyon, an enchanted opening from the mysterious recesses of the earth. Native American folklore states that the Grand Canyon was formed as a result of a great deluge which had drowned the previous third world, and Hopi cosmology specifies that this canyon was the exact place where the Hopi emerged from their subterranean refuge after a great flood had destroyed the previous age. There are several inner world entry points that are said to be located on their land in the canyon. One of them is very revered and honored in ceremony as the dwelling of an ancient parent race, and this sacred site is strictly off limits to all but the Hopi people themselves. The lore further claims that the Hopi were assisted by what they describe as an ant people who lived in the inner world in the caves and caverns, and they're described by some elders as being pale humanoids with thin limbs, slightly arched backs, and people working for the Smithsonian may also have actually discovered artifacts inside some massive caverns with intricate passages, rooms that include tables with hieroglyphs, and was actually an article published in the Arizona Gazette on April 5th, 1909, that states that the Grand Canyon was once home to a lost civilization that consisted of people of gigantic proportions, or giants. Could the Hopi Indian myths have been based in fact? Over the past century, numerous archaeologists have planned to go searching for this mythical world, but exploration of internal caverns and caves are off limits and forbidden by law. If an Atlantis-like settlement did ever exist underground within the canyon, could there still be civilizations that exist deep beneath the earth? And if so, where are these entrances to these inner worlds, and who could possibly inhabit them? John Wesley Powell was the first person to travel the entire Colorado River. In his book, Explorations of the Colorado River and Its Canyons, he writes, quote, "In this, great numbers of caves are hollowed out, and carvings are seen which suggest architectural forms, though on a scale so grand that architectural terms belittle them. As this great bed forms a distinctive feature of the canyon, we call it Marble Canyon. I walk down the gorge to the left at the foot of the cliff, climb to a bench, and discover a trail deeply worn into the rock, where it crosses the side, gulches in some places, steps have been cut. I can see no evidence of it having been traveled for a long time. It was doubtless a path used by people who inhabited this country anterior to the present Indian races, the people who built the communal houses of which mention has been made. I return to camp about 3 o'clock and find that some of the men have discovered ruins and many fragments of pottery, also etchings and hieroglyphics on the rocks." That said, the Smithsonian has denied the validity of the claims published in 1909, but as I've pointed out in a previous video that I made regarding dozens of other independent discoveries of giant skeletons discovered in America during the early 20th and 19th century. None of these finds published in papers such as the New York Times can be accounted for either. So there's plenty of precedent for the Smithsonian losing artifacts or information about discoveries that do not fit in with currently accepted dogma about the history of America and its interaction with other ancient civilizations. But why would the Smithsonian cover up something like this? Because it would change the entire history of North America as we know it, and would not align with how history was written up in the textbooks, which promote a certain political agenda. Modern-day archaeologists largely dismiss anything remotely related to any stories like this, because it's not what universities teach. It's funny that just because something isn't written in the officially approved curriculum, it's discounted as false. The idea that our planet consists of a hollow or honeycombed interior is not new. Some of the oldest cultures speak of civilizations inside of vast cavern cities within the bowels of the earth. According to certain Buddhist and Hindu traditions, secret tunnels connect Tibet with a subterranean paradise, and they call this legendary underworld Agartha. In India, this underground oasis is best known by its Sanskrit name, Shambhala, thought to mean place of tranquility. Mythologies throughout the world, from South America to the Arctic, describe numerous entrances to these fabled inner kingdoms. Many occult organizations, esoteric authors, and secret societies concur with these myths and legends of subterranean inhabitants who are the remnants of antediluvian civilizations which sought refuge in hollow caverns inside the earth. Assuming that the myths are true, and the earth is at least partially hollow, how could life survive underground? Surface trees and rainforests are responsible for less than one-third of the earth's oxygen, while marine plants, such as phytoplankton, are responsible for up to 75% of the oxygen in the earth's atmosphere, depending on season. The vast majority of our oxygen comes from aquatic organisms. Phytoplankton, kelp, and algae produce oxygen as a byproduct of photosynthesis, a process which converts carbon dioxide and light into sugars, which are then used for energy. While the process of photosynthesis usually implies the presence of sunlight, the sun is not the only available light or energy source able to power photosynthesis. Before the discovery of hydrothermal vents and their ecosystems, scientists believed that only small animals lived at the ocean bottom, in seafloor sediments. They theorized that these animals received their food from above because the established model of marine food chain depended on sunlight and photosynthesis, just as the food chain on land does. Mainstream academia taught that this was the only way life could survive in the darkest of the deep seafloor. The discovery of hydrothermal vents changed all that. It became clear that these vast communities of animals grew quickly and to larger than expected sizes in the depths without the aid of the sun. Instead of using light to create organic material through photosynthesis, microorganisms at the bottom of the food chain at hydrothermal vents use chemicals such as hydrogen sulfide in what is called chemosynthesis. At the seafloor, there are thriving ecosystems that receive energy not from the sun, but from the heat and chemicals provided by the planet itself. For many thousands of species dwelling in the deep, the energy to sustain life does not flow down from above, but comes up from the interior of the earth. Even in the unlikely scenario where every single tree were to be chopped down, we would still be able to breathe thanks to aquatic plant life, for example, algae. The earth has a tremendous amount of water, and these oceans, rivers, and lakes are teeming with numerous species of biologically active, oxygen-producing organisms. That said, one might ask the question, are there any known sources of sustenance available that could provide for a large human population? Since there are known subterranean sources of water, such as lakes and rivers, teeming with algae, there's also a food chain that lives off the algae, such as shrimps, fish, and other aquatic life. There's also another food source, which also doubles as a light source. Lichen is a composite organism that arises from algae in a mutualistic relationship with multiple fungi species. Lichen comes in many colors, sizes, and forms, and are sometimes plant-like, similar to moss, but lichens are not related to mosses or any plant. They're often found growing on rock, have adapted to survive in some of the most extreme environments on Earth, and lichens have been known to glow, as have other fungal species, such as bioluminescent mushrooms, or even glowing algae and other organisms. So not only are some forms of lichen edible, even served in some Scandinavian restaurants as a delicacy, but may contribute as a potential light source. The Buddhists, in their theology, fervently believe that subterranean civilizations exist. They believe these underground people belong to a superior race of men and women who occasionally come to the surface to oversee the development of humanity above ground. Whether this is actually done as a malevolent or benevolent act depends on perspective, and for many people is up for debate. While the inner earth civilization is called Agartha, and the capital city often referred to as Shambhala, whose ruler is said to have given orders to the Dalai Lama in the past, transmitted through certain secret tunnels connecting this inner world with Tibet, possibly its capital city, Lhasa. The entrance of this tunnel was guarded by lamas who were sworn to secrecy, but there has been rumors that these secrets were handed over to the Nationalist Socialist Party of Germany, which sent numerous archaeological expeditions to Tibet trying to find fossilized remains of giants, among other things, such as an alleged attempt by the Ananarbe, or Ancestral Heritage Research Organization, to establish communications with what they considered true supermen, who were said to have mastered the forces of the living universe, which they called Vril, but is also known as Chi, Ki, Prana, Orgone, and to alchemists, Ether. In the book, The Spear of Destiny, Trevor Ravenscroft says, quote, "It was largely through the initiative of Professor Karl Haushofer and other members of the Vril Society in Berlin and Munich that exploratory teams were sent out to Tibet. The succession of German expeditions to Tibet, which took place annually from 1926 to 1942, sought to establish contact with cave communities. 3 years after the first contact had been made with the adepts of Agartha and Shambhala, a Tibetan community was established in Germany with branches in Berlin, Munich, and Nuremberg. The adepts of Agartha were known in Germany as the Society of Green Men, and strong measures were taken to keep silence about their real significance. They were joined by 7 members of the Green Dragon Society of Japan, with whom they had been in communication for hundreds of years. During the final months of the war, when the Russians reached their quarters in the suburbs of Berlin, they discovered their naked bodies lying in orderly rows, each with a ceremonial knife piercing the abdomen." In Dietrich Bronder's 1975 book, Before Hitler Came, we read, quote, "In 1928, the Thule Society, via the strong Tibetan colony in Berlin, with which Haushofer was in permanent contact, is said to have resumed the links to Tibet's secret societies of monks, which were even maintained during the Second World War. They used, in radio communications between Berlin and the Tibetan capital of Lhasa at this time, was the book Dzayan, a secret book of magic of Tibetan sages. The links to Tibetan Buddhism forged by Trebisch, Haushofer, and Hess were represented by Karo Nietzsche, an emissary of the Tibetan Agartha in Berlin. He wore the brush-shaped mustache that indicated an adept. On the evening before the outbreak of the Second World War, Schaffer's SS expedition departed from Germany for Tibet, guided by Koronichi and Eva Spulmuller, bringing the Dalai Lama radio equipment with which to set up links between Lhasa and Berlin. Schaffer's SS men were permitted to enter the holy city of Lhasa, otherwise barred to Europeans and Christians, and even the Lama's magnificent temple containing one single enormous object, the holiest symbol of the Mongolian Empire, the swastika. In a French book, Le Temps Kabbaliste, which translates to Kabbalist time, it says, quote, "There was continuous contact between National Socialist Germany and Tibet." There were also claims that Schaffer had brought the Führer a document of inestimable value and that the Führer locked it away in a dark corner of the bunker at Rastenburg, where he was said to meditate. This document was a parchment on which the Dalai Lama had signed a pact of friendship with Nationalist Germany, where Hitler was known to him as head of the Aryans. One item out of all those brought back by Schaffer deserved particular attention, the Tantra ritual Kalachakra, and a detailed dossier containing this tantric initiation, the first document on this subject to reach the West. Meaning to weave in Sanskrit, the term Tantra implies to a set of spiritual practices that direct the universal energies into the practitioner, thereby leading to liberation from the physical level of existence. Samadhi is a state of consciousness characterized by clarity of perception and the absence of the ego. It is the state of consciousness sought by all schools of meditation, a piercing of the veils of one's own subconscious mind into the superconscious. This and other occult spiritual techniques were said to have been practiced by members of the Thule and Vril societies in Germany. The medium Maria Orsic was leader of the Vrillerinnen, comprised of beautiful young ladies who in pre-World War II Germany conducted research into psychic phenomena and advanced propulsion technology, including saucer-shaped aircraft known in ancient Sanskrit text as Vimanas. Their Vril society, whose members included some of who would later become notable members of the Nationalist Socialist Party, believed that many ancient civilizations owed their origins to refugees from Atlantis and the people that dwelt inside of the earth. They advanced the idea of a subterranean civilization ruled by an ancient parent race who had mastered free energy. This Aryan breakaway civilization was said to have survived the antediluvian cataclysms which ended the Ice Age and continued to thrive below the surface of the earth. Before World War II, Germany claimed the territory of New Swabia, or Neuschwabenland, in Antarctica, previously known as Queen Maud Land, and sent expeditions there, including the last one in 1938, where they began building secret deep underground bases below the ice, only reachable by U-boat or submarine. They then defeated a post-World War II attack by Allied forces in 1946, led by Admiral Byrd, who took over 4,000 military troops from the US, Britain, and Australia into an invasion of Antarctica, where his forces encountered heavy resistance from unusual saucer-shaped craft that inflicted substantial damages and caused them to retreat. According to a published interview he gave, which is translated from Spanish and published in my own book, stating that it was, quote, "necessary for the U.S. to take defensive action against enemy air fighters which come from the polar regions." Shortly after, Secretary of Defense James Forrestal allegedly committed suicide, while some close to him suspect that he was actually thrown out of a window. The true events of his mission in Antarctica, which were rumored to have included finding an entrance to inner Earth, are still kept top secret and confidential as Operation High Jump. Which finally brings us to the Nazi maps that were leaked to the public after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, which not only gave detailed U-boat directions of how to enter the inner Earth below the ice in Antarctica, but provided a detailed map of the subterranean landscape which they called Asgard, which in Norse and Germanic mythology is the name of the dwelling place of the gods, comparable to the Greek Mount Olympus. Legend divided Asgard into 12 or more realms, including Valhalla, the home of Odin, and the abode of the heroes slain in earthly battle. According to certain translations of Norse poems, Asgard is located in the center of the world, and according to these National Socialist maps, the inner Earth realm is also the location of Neu-Berlin, which apparently is a city situated on what appears to be an island that is labeled as Neuschwabenland. While the map is dismissed by mainstream historians and mainstream media, as can be verified by a simple search on Google, let's not forget this is the same Google whose mainstream AI depicts Nazi soldiers as sub-Saharan African, not to mention the Pope as black, as well as Nubian Vikings. That said, there has been alleged corroboration by a letter from a German U-boat navigator named Karl Unger, who claims U-209 made it to Agartha, or Asgard, and that the Earth does in fact contain areas that are hollow, stating that Karl Haushofer and Rudolf Hess were correct about the hollow Earth theory.
I found a few more things that pertain to inner Earth here. They say the Germans said to have made it in there in what they called the underworld of Agartha. Here we see a translated letter. This message will be a surprise to you. The U-boat 209 has made it. The Earth is hollow. Dr. Haushofer and Hess were right. The whole crew is doing well, but they cannot come back. We are no prisoners. I am certain that this message will reach you. It is the last contact with the U-209. We will meet again, comrade. I am worried about the people that have to live on the surface since the Führer is gone. God bless our Germany always. With hearty greetings, Karl Unger. Yeah, he's right to worry about the people on the surface. Look at what's happening to them right now.
Es gibt ein Haus in Neu-Berlin. Man nennt es Haus Abendrot. Es war der Ruin vieler guter Jungs. Von mir, mein Gott, litt ich Not.
My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon and through all other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description. Please subscribe for future updates. Leave your thoughts below. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.